the consensus dissolves. In the years following AZT's approval, a flood of studies on AIDS patients have poured forth, illustrating frightening toxicity. None have included placebo groups, an omission rationalized by ethical concerns that patients should not be denied such a miracle drug, but the numbers speak for themselves. 2 years after the end of the official Phase II trial, a group of French physicians working at the Claude Bernard Hospital in Paris published another study on hundreds of AIDS patients. All used high-dose AZT for an average of 7 months. One-third of the patients experienced a worsening of their AIDS conditions, and a slightly higher percentage developed new AIDS diseases. By 9 months, one of every five patients had died, a rate far higher than in the official study, which also used the high dose. The bone marrow toxicity of AZT and the frequent need for other drugs with hematological blood toxicity meant that the scheduled AZT regimen could be maintained in only a few patients, wrote the authors. This is matched other findings. In most studies, half of any group of people suffer an immediate reaction so severe that they must stop. The French doctors cast a cloud of pessimism, noting that in AIDS and ARC patients, the rationale for adhering to high-dose regimens of AZT, which in many instances leads to toxicity and interruption of treatment, seems questionable. In England, one group of researchers described the medical consequences of AZT in 13 patients. All 13 developed severe anemia, Mir and Costello. A subsequent Australian study reported the consequences of treating more than 300 patients for 1 to 1.5 years. More than half developed a new AIDS disease during the first year, and exactly half needed blood transfusions to survive. Nearly one-third died. A Dutch study found still deadlier results. After a little more than a year, most of their 91 patients needed blood transfusions, and almost three-quarters died. The Dutch researchers despaired at prescribing AZT, warning that most of their patients simply could not stay on the drug for loss of blood cells. A new complication surfaced in 1990. The National Cancer Institute analyzed the status of AIDS patients who had participated in Broder's Phase 1 trial and uncovered the fact that of all the people using AZT for 3 years, half were developing lymphoma. This is a deadly cancer of white blood cells akin to leukemia, but forming solid tumors in the body, and also happens to be included on the official list of AIDS diseases blamed on HIV. Since AZT was killing and damaging those same white blood cells, the drug stood out as the likely culprit. Virus hunters rushed to the drug's defense. Some massaged the statistics to lower the lymphoma rate, while others turned the news completely upside down by claiming AZT actually helped patients live longer long enough to get lymphoma. Paul Volberdien, one of the leading organizers in the Phase 2 trial, told one interviewer, "So we see the lymphomas as an unfortunate reflection of our success at this point, rather than a reason for real caution." Certainly, AIDS officials can hardly be accused of caution when it comes to AZT. Nor does their explanation wash, since only 3% of all AIDS patients tend to get lymphoma as their AIDS-defining disease, not 50% as in Broder's AZT trial. AZT, furthermore, has given evidence of cancer-causing abilities when tested. A few small studies have tested the reverse to see what happens to AIDS patients who stop AZT use. In one group of four patients who developed massive blood cell loss weeks after starting AZT, three recovered after the doctor took all four off the drug. Another group of five patients suffered muscle wasting, a symptom that disappeared in four cases only a couple of weeks after stopping AZT. Two of these patients lapsed back into the condition after restarting the drug. In the most dramatic such experiment, a doctor took 11 of his worsening AIDS patients off AZT. The immune systems of 10 immediately rebounded and several continued improving. Yet no amount of warning data could dissuade AIDS officials from abandoning their antiviral compound. Having won approval for treating AIDS patients, Burroughs Wellcome and the NIH moved to have AZT recommended as a preventative drug for HIV-positive people without symptoms. This time, Anthony Fauci directed the experiment as a project of NIAID, the NIH division he headed. Burroughs Wellcome again financed much of the study, paying hospitals for participating, and several of its consultants again joined in. Margaret Fischel and many other Phase 2 researchers signed up, and Paul Volberdien secured the top position as organizer. But now a stupendous number of scientists were recruited. The final paper mentioned 130 authors, which Volberding called a partial list. The investigators read like a who's who among leading virus hunters and medical doctors involved in AIDS research. With that many prominent researchers involved, few colleagues remained to act as independent reviewers. The study's political success was virtually guaranteed regardless of its outcome. Volberding and his colleagues enrolled more than 1,300 HIV-positive healthy persons from AIDS risk groups, none of whom had AIDS diseases. The subjects were divided into three groups: placebo, high-dose AZT, and, because of growing worries about the drug's toxicity, a low-dose AZT group. Protocol, as Fauci designated it, quickly degenerated into a repeat performance of the Phase 2 trial. More cancers, including Kaposi's sarcoma, occurred in the placebo group, hinting that more users of poppers or other recreational drugs may have ended up there, biasing the results in favor of AZT. The double-blind controls broke down again, a fact that was covered up publicly. But in the text of the paper, Volberding acknowledged that the dropout patients tended to come from the AZT treatment groups, removing some of the sickest victims. Having also anticipated sharing of AZT between patients, he had their blood tested for the actual presence of the drug. 9% of the placebo group were caught with traces of AZT, while almost 20% of the AZT group showed no evidence of ever having used the drug. The study was terminated early after patients had been treated for an average of 1 year. The final analysis showed the AZT groups with fewer AIDS diagnoses than the placebo, but the toxic side effects of AZT swamped this small difference. The low-dose group had as many sick people as the placebo group, although their blood disorders and immune deficiency were not called AIDS. The high-dose group suffered by far the most, having dozens of deathly ill patients. By calling diseases in the placebo group AIDS while avoiding that diagnosis for the AZT groups, Volberding successfully won an FDA recommendation for using the drug on healthy HIV-positive people. In 1994, Volberding published a stunning aftermath to protocol. The T cells of 2.9% of the men in the placebo group had increased gradually over 2 years, while those of the AZT recipients had decreased. It is probable that under clinical surveillance, the 29% whose T cells increased despite the presence of the alleged T cell killer HIV had given up or reduced their recreational drug use. After studying patients for another 5 years, Volberding, the father of AZT prophylaxis, came to a new conclusion about AZT. Zidovudine, AZT, does not significantly prolong either AIDS-free or overall survival. Stated otherwise, hundreds of thousands of healthy people had taken AZT for 5 years for no significant reason, assuming that DNA chain termination is indeed not significant. In an article entitled Early Intervention, An Idea Whose Time Has Gone, the New York native writes on Volberding's latest insight. The same group of people that has continued to insist that early intervention with AZT is necessary and beneficial despite data showing that people who take AZT earlier also die earlier and that their quality of life is so diminished as to negate completely any alleged benefits from AZT have now published research showing that, after all, AZT does not prevent progression to AIDS or delay death. The magnitude of this about-face cannot be overstated. Not totally convinced by Volberding's original trial, other researchers put together two long-term studies on AZT's preventative effects. An American research group sponsored by the Department of Veterans Affairs ran a 2-year trial comparing patients who used AZT before symptoms, the early group, to those using it afterward, the late group. These scientists found that the early group actually died slightly more often and a bit faster than the late group, but the differences were small. They concluded AZT showed no survival benefits whatsoever when used for prevention. The news hit the stock market with force, knocking down the value of Burroughs Wellcome shares some 10% in 1 day. British and French scientists organized a similar study known as the Concord trial, while Volberding's study was still in progress. The Concord study treated two groups with AZT, one before AIDS symptoms, the early group, and the other after, the late group. Only people without AIDS symptoms were recruited into the study, the late group receiving a placebo until after they contracted AIDS. Apparently, the researchers were seeing enormous toxicity as the study progressed, for midway through, a minor crisis erupted. The scientists became divided over whether to continue or abort early. At a meeting behind closed doors, an audience member secretly recorded Chairman Ian Weller as he voiced the increasing concerns. If there is benefit to AZT therapy, is it maintained or will it wear off? In which case, we may do more harm than good. The study organizers voted to continue, albeit nervously. After each patient had participated for 3 years, the researchers came out in 1994 to announce publicly that they could find no difference in survival between the early and late treatment groups. In reality, the early AZT group had done worse than estimated. The death rate in the AZT group was 25% higher than in the control group, hardly a recommendation for AZT prophylaxis. The double-blinded controls again seemed to have dissipated, for symptom-free patients could easily know they were on AZT by its potent toxicity. Many of these AZT patients could no longer tolerate the nausea, vomiting, and anemia, but they did not have the courage to confront their doctors. So, according to at least one report, they have thrown their tablets down the toilet. This would artificially lower some of the apparent toxicity in the early group. But the news of no positive benefits did stun the AIDS establishments in all countries, sending various officials scrambling for excuses to explain away the Concord results. This study has provided the heaviest blow yet against AZT, and the first signs of retreat are beginning to emerge. Based on a preliminary report on the Concord study, on June 25, 1993, an NIH panel formally announced new guidelines for AZT use, recommending that doctors and patients use more caution. AZT has benefits, but we are admitting that it is not as good a drug as we thought it was, said the committee chairman. Further bad news came from America. One investigation of AZT as prophylaxis against AIDS dementia showed in 1994 that, contrary to expectation, there was twice as much dementia in AZT-treated homosexuals than in untreated counterparts. Also in 1994, a large American study reached an even more damning verdict on AZT prophylaxis. It found that HIV-positive hemophiliacs had 2.4 times higher mortality and a 4.5 times higher AIDS risk rate than untreated HIV-positive hemophiliacs. It may not have been just a coincidence that Sam Broder resigned, apparently at the height of his career, as director of the National Cancer Institute in December 1994. In April 1995, an American study found that AZT treatment doubled or quadrupled the risk for HIV-positive male homosexuals to develop pneumocystis pneumonia. In July 1995, the British Medical Journal published that AZT prophylaxis reduces the time to death of HIV-positive AIDS patients from 3 years without AZT to 2 years with AZT. The emerging concerns about AZT treatment are summarized dramatically in a letter from a German doctor to the editor of Nature. To the editor, as a hospital doctor, I come face to face every day with the disaster that Gallo and his colleagues have brought about. In the case of each patient with tuberculosis, each patient with herpes zoster, each patient with toxoplasmosis or cytomegalovirus infections, I am confronted with the thought that if these patients were HIV positive, they would, as things currently stand, have to undergo antiviral therapy. The substances available are pure chemotherapeutic agents, which means that in treating them, I bring about the very illness I seek to bring under control. In effect, this means leading the patients to their deaths. As a result of the AIDS virus hypothesis, things have now reached the stage where treatment of the disease itself gives rise to the bleak prognosis for the disease. Klaus Cohenklein, M.D., Kiel, February 28, 1995. In his response to Cohenklein, John Maddox, the editor of Nature, wrote on September 20, 1995, "But it seems to me that there are two separate issues. Is AZT dangerous in itself, and does HIV cause, not cause, AIDS? Only physicians such as yourself can establish the first point, but it seems to me that by now there must be a great deal of clinical data on which you and your colleagues could draw to reach a substantial conclusion that could be published. You say that the Ho and We papers we published in February, it was January, are unconvincing because their work is based on the AIDS virus hypothesis. But how can you dismiss their finding of very large quantities of virus in the blood of people with HIV infection, and the temporary effectiveness of the protease inhibitor whose design is specifically determined by the sequence of HIV used in their study? I should add that a hemophiliac relative of my wife died of AIDS this year. He was infected before 1984 and diagnosed with antibodies against HIV in 1985. His first symptoms of AIDS appeared about 1989. American gay activists from ACT UP San Francisco who used to conform with the HIV orthodoxy have recently also begun to protest AZT therapy with violence, crashing the 10-year anniversary party of Martin Delaney's AIDS organization Project Inform and turning over tables at the plush Hyatt Regency Hotel in San Francisco. Protesters shouted into the faces of Delaney and his guests Larry Kramer and Anthony Fauci, "Tony Fauci, you killed our friends. This is where the murder ends." According to Spin reporter Celia Farber, the protesters picked the occasion because Project Inform, they insist, has become so entrenched with authoritarian establishment old boy network views on AIDS that it has betrayed the community. In a press release, the ACT UP protesters listed their complaints of May 6, 1995. "The past decade of human tragedy has shown us that trying to kill the AIDS virus with high-priced drugs like AZT and DDL harms the people who take them. These compounds make people sick, are not created to be taken for prolonged periods of time, and are immunosuppressive. Enough is enough. This ongoing circus of death must be questioned. Government-sponsored clinical trials of drugs are obviously not meant to save our lives. These trials are meant to document the drug's effect on laboratory markers that have little, if any, correlation to the health or survival of people with HIV disease. People with HIV need to concentrate on activating their cellular immunity in order to control the opportunistic infections that threaten our lives. Fauci knows this, has admitted it, and still does nothing. With 270,000 dead from AIDS and millions more infected with HIV, you, Fauci, should not be honored at a dinner. You should be put before a firing squad." On July 22, 1995, even the establishment media sent out a signal of distress. The New York Times published the following letter condemning AZT studies. To the editor, "The recent study casting doubt on azithromycin's AZT alleged therapeutic benefits for carriers of the human immunodeficiency virus, news article July 16th from the British Medical Journal cited above, contrasts with the majority of AZT studies in which the drug is claimed to be beneficial. The best way to resolve the AZT disagreement might be to gather as many of the original articles as possible to see if the experiments were done well. In AIDS research, funding sources can also be illuminating. Here is what I found after reviewing more than 25 studies on AZT. Evidence of AZT's inefficiency and toxicity has been around a long time, well before the 1994 Concord studies or the 1992 Veterans Affairs Cooperative study. Negative data on AZT were published in The Lancet, the British Medical Journal, in December 1988. Those data were not highly publicized. While the absolute number of studies casting doubt on AZT is small, they tend to have two things in common: good experimental design and independent funding. The more numerous studies supporting AZT's benefits tended to use inappropriate experimental designs and very short follow-up times. Moreover, these studies were financed, at least in part, by the drug's maker, the Burroughs Wellcome Company." Timothy H. Hand, Atlanta, July 17th. 1995. Considering the faithful commitment of the New York Times to HIV orthodoxy since 1984, the publication of this letter assumes outstanding significance. In this era of centralized, government-sponsored science, an article against politically correct science can be fatal for a journalist. In such a climate, the publication of a letter is a journal's last resort of expressing a dissenting opinion. AZT, known for decades as a failed and toxic cancer chemotherapy, was resurrected for political reasons and rushed through the FDA's first fast-track approval. By its very nature, such a drug could only worsen AIDS if not cause some AIDS diseases by itself. One experiment after another, despite flaws, has confirmed the drug's toxicity in humans, yet only now is the AIDS establishment slowly backing down. The virus hunters bring tremendous political and financial momentum behind each of their projects, and AIDS treatment is no exception. Preventing HIV infection, the last stand of the AZT lobby. The recent growth of opposition to AZT may save lives in the future, but it is coming too late for some victims. Convinced of the drug's alleged success, the AIDS establishment has aggressively promoted AZT wherever it could, despite the drug's poor performance. Often the treatment is paid for by one federal program or another, creating an indirect subsidy of Burroughs' welcome by the taxpayers. In 1992, at least 80,000 people worldwide took the drug every day. Frustrated with its failings to cure AIDS and then even to prevent it, the AZT lobby has concentrated on a last front to save its drug, the prevention of infection. As usual, in the rush to save lives, there was no time for theory. To prevent HIV infection, a drug would have to shut down all cell growth in the body for several weeks. This is because retroviruses like HIV depend on cell division for reproduction and therefore infection. If only a few cells continued to divide, the defense against HIV would be useless. But to achieve a complete shutdown of cell division, so much AZT must be administered that survival is impossible. Even the highest doses ever prescribed would not suffice. Given the choice between lethal doses of AZT that could prevent infection but would likely kill the patient and not to use AZT at all, the AZT establishment chose to compromise. By treating with known doses, most patients would survive long enough to obscure all drug-mediated diseases by HIV-mediated diseases that are expected to occur late after infection. The early months of 1989 brought an unusual notice posted in the buildings of the NIH. Entitled HIV Safety Notice, it announced a new policy established by the director himself. Any employee of the NIH who underwent accidental exposure to HIV, as for example by a needle stick injury, would be offered preventative AZT. According to the notice, the advisory group in providing their recommendations emphasized that administration of AZT should be initiated as soon as possible, preferably within hours following the exposure. Only first aid for the injury itself would precede AZT. Numerous medical institutions have since adopted this policy, and a 1993 report in Lancet revealed the practical application. The paper described a doctor who was accidentally stuck by a needle and thus exposed to HIV-infected blood. The doctor began taking AZT within the hour and continued for 6 weeks, too quickly even to do an HIV test. Thus, medical workers may use AZT even if they never become infected with HIV. But this doctor became HIV positive despite the toxic prophylaxis. A second and more disturbing announcement reached the public in the summer of 1989. NIAID, the NIH division under Anthony Fauci, declared it would be conducting trials of AZT on pregnant mothers infected with HIV. A drug that interferes with growth can lead only to physical deformities in babies developing in the womb. The study, financed through the NIH budget, ironically recruited mothers who had been injection drug addicts. Apparently, Fauci believes heroin addiction poses less of a threat to children than does HIV. Some of their babies, moreover, may never even contract the virus from their mothers, but will receive AZT anyway. Following his lead, the French joined Fauci's trial, and the British government in 1993 began on its own a study of AZT effects on HIV-positive babies. However, to prescribe a known mutagenic drug to a pregnant woman was a risky departure from the foremost medical principle, first, do no harm. According to AIDS reporter Celia Farber in April 1995, though AZT is widely claimed to have been deemed safe in pregnant women, in fact, the FDA did not think so and never allowed pregnant women to take it prior to this study, primarily because it was classified as mutagenic. Another mutagenic drug, thalidomide, was prescribed as a sedative throughout Great Britain and Germany in the 1950s, but was never approved in the U.S. Thalidomide was responsible for over 10,000 birth defects in children born to mothers who had taken the drug during gestation. Many of the infants were born with missing or partially missing limbs. From that point on, no potentially mutagenic chemical was to be taken by pregnant women, for any reason. AZT in pregnant women represents a radical break in this tradition. In February of 1994, Fauci's American-French trial on pregnant women was abruptly terminated. Fauci and his collaborators claimed victory because AZT had reduced maternal HIV transmission rate by two-thirds, from 25% without treatment to 8% with AZT treatment. This euphemism was chosen for the net result that out of 180 babies born to AZT-treated mothers, 13 had been found HIV positive compared to 40 out of 184 born to placebo-treated mothers. In other words, to save 27 babies, 17%, from HIV infection, 180 mothers and 153 of their unborn infants who either did not pick up HIV from their mothers or picked it up despite AZT were first treated for 6 to 20 weeks every 5 hours with 100 milligrams AZT and then again intravenously during delivery. In addition, the newborn babies were given 2 milligrams AZT every 6 hours for the first 6 weeks of their lives. In view of the possible genetic damage from AZT, Fauci acknowledged long-term follow-up of all the children is essential to learn more about the risks and benefits of the treatment beyond these encouraging early results. Recommendations on treatment were said to be pending developments of consensus on the balance between known benefits and unknown risks. There is, of course, a double irony in this apparent caution. First, the benefit of being HIV-free is currently not known because there is no proof that HIV causes AIDS. Second, the risk of AZT is certainly not unknown 30 years after it was first developed to kill human cells for cancer chemotherapy. After declaring victory against HIV transmission, the double-blind controls were officially broken prematurely and AZT was offered to all mothers. Clearly, the 124 primary and secondary authors of the maternal transmission study achieved consensus on playing down the adverse experiences of babies on AZT, acknowledging only that the level of hemoglobin at birth in the infants in the zidovudine group was significantly lower than in the infants of the placebo group. However, the neutropenia, high bilirubin levels, and anemia reported prior to final publication were not documented in the consensus paper. The AZT-induced neutropenia, the medical term for a critical shortage of the majority of immune cells in the blood, could very well be the explanation for the AZT-mediated reduction of HIV transmission. Since HIV replicates in blood cells and blood cell synthesis is inhibited by AZT, it is no surprise that HIV is less likely to be transmitted if the cells in which it replicates are killed by AZT, both in the mother and the unborn child. An editorial in Lancet did not share Fauci's optimism. The most worrisome aspect is the possibility of long-term adverse effects on children exposed to zidovudine, AZT, during fetal life, especially since the vast majority would not have been infected anyway. Indeed, the as-yet-unpublished side effects of the American-French study confirmed this sinister projection, according to Farber's article. There were 2 birth defects. One had extra digits and a heart defect. The second had an extra digit on both hands. The report concluded that neither case was related to AZT therapy. A formal request by the New York native for an official account of the unpublished birth defects was denied by the Assistant Secretary for Health, Dr. Philip R. Lee. Lee advised the reporter on January 6, 1994, to sue the federal government. But a study from outside the United States provided a clearer picture. 8 spontaneous abortions, 8 therapeutic abortions, and 8 serious birth defects, including extra digits, were recorded among babies of 104 HIV-positive pregnant women treated with AZT. The trust in medical authority breaks down. Long-term survivors of AIDS know better than to use AZT. Michael Callan was diagnosed with full-blown AIDS in 1982 before HIV had ever been isolated. Given little time to live, he discovered Joe Sonnabend and switched doctors. Callan had participated in the fast-track homosexual scene for a decade, including sex with more than 3,000 partners and the attendant drug abuse. His lifestyle changed radically on Sonnabend's advice, although he began taking enormous amounts of antibiotics and sulfa drugs. Because of his cleaned-up lifestyle and his ongoing refusal to take AZT, Callan lived 12 years with an AIDS diagnosis until he died with pulmonary Kaposi's sarcoma in 1994. He told his story in his 1990 book, Surviving AIDS, along with the stories of several other long-term survivors who tend to avoid AZT. For that matter, the CDC estimated that 1 million Americans had HIV by 1985, but 2/3 of those have not developed AIDS at all in the past 10 years. Most HIV positives have never received AZT. In New York, Michael Elner runs a self-help group to help AIDS patients live. Named HEAL, Health Education AIDS Liaison, it strongly advises members against AZT. And a 1990 article in Parade magazine profiled 13 AIDS cases who had survived their diagnosis for 5 years. They rejected AZT as counterproductive. It's incredible, isn't it, that the drug designed to save you can also kill you? Says Mike Leonard, a survivor. It can make you anemic and you end up having to get blood transfusions. In London, HIV-positive male homosexuals at risk for AIDS formed a survivor group called Continuum. In August 1993, there was no mortality during 1.25 years, and all 918 members of that group who had avoided the experimental medications on offer and chose to abstain from or significantly reduce their use of recreational drugs, including alcohol. Assuming an average 10-year latent period from HIV to AIDS, the virus-AIDS hypothesis would have predicted at least 58, half of 928 over 10 times 1.25 AIDS cases among 918 HIV positives over 1.25 years. Indeed, the absence of mortality in this group over 1.25 years corresponds to a minimal latent period from HIV to AIDS of more than 1,148, 918 times 1.25 years. As of July 1, 1994, there was still not one single AIDS case in this group of 918 HIV-positive homosexuals. Other individuals began to take their health in their own hands rather than rely on medical authority for the treatment of HIV. In terms of notoriety, the list is led by one of the nation's top basketball stars, Irvin Magic Johnson. In November 1991, Magic proved to be HIV-positive when he applied for a marriage license. Magic was totally healthy until AIDS specialist Anthony Fauci from the NIH, David Ho, now director of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center in New York, and Magic's personal doctor advised AIDS prophylaxis with AZT. Magic's health changed radically within a few days. The press wrote in December 1991, "Magic reeling as worst nightmare comes true. He's getting sicker." Only after he began taking AZT did Magic's health begin to decline. He had lost his appetite and suffered from bouts of nausea and fatigue and complained, "I feel like vomiting almost every day." But then suddenly, Magic's AIDS symptoms disappeared, and so did all further news about his AIDS symptoms and treatment. Had Magic's virus suddenly become harmless, or was Magic taken off AZT? No paper would mention whether Magic was taken off AZT. Nobody knew, except those who joked, "There is no Magic in AZT, and there is no AZT in Magic." Indeed, it is very unlikely that he could have won the Olympics in 1992 on AZT, considering his strong reactions to the toxic drug in 1991. The silence of the AIDS establishment seems to confirm this assumption. Nothing would have been a better advertisement for the troubled AIDS drug than having returned AIDS patient Magic to an Olympic victory. But no such announcement was made. At last, Magic broke the silence himself. After a motivational AIDS talk in Tallahassee, Florida in the spring of 1995, Magic responded to a teacher that he had been taking AZT for a while, but has stopped. The media preferred not to mention the news. About 6 years earlier, another young man fought the battle of his life, having been discharged by the U.S. Navy for being HIV antibody positive. Rafael Lombardo has won his one-man campaign against the Navy and the AIDS establishment all by himself. His letter proves that true science does not depend on institutional authority. To Dr. Peter Duisberg, from Rafael Sabato Lombardo, date May 30, 1995. Subject, Life Without AZT. Dear Dr. Duisberg, my name is Rafael Sabato Lombardo, 33 years old and from Cape Coral, Florida. I'm writing in regards to the enclosed magazine article from this month's issue of Men's Style. I was thrilled to read that there was someone in the medical profession who shared the same views I've had for so many years. I am an HIV-positive individual. I learned of my HIV status while in boot camp in the U.S. Navy back in 1985. I could have very possibly been HIV-positive 7 years before that. The Navy wanted to discharge me and others, and dishonorably at that. Feeling my constitutional rights were being violated, I and several others dragged the U.S. Navy into the Federal District Courts of Washington, D.C. for one of the very first AIDS litigation cases ever. I was acting spokesperson for the group. The enclosed newspaper articles will give you some insight into exactly what transpired during this time. Going back to my small hometown after all of this publicity was not easy. Remember, this was 1985, a time when HIV was called the HTLV-3 virus, and anything and everyone associated with it meant complete and utter doom, physically, spiritually, societally, politically, etc., or so they thought. After discharge, my parents and family insisted I come home and finish school. Education was always stressed in our household and looked upon as the only means of moving ahead in life. My parents, who were at great risk of losing their mom-and-pop Italian deli business, which still exists today, also wanted me home so I could do the most important thing, maintain my health. Although met with discrimination and much verbal and physical abuse as well, I did go home and received my bachelor's in business from the University of South Florida, Fort Myers. The past 6 years, I have been working as a field auditor for the largest and oldest newspaper magazine circulation auditing firm in the world, the Audit Bureau of Circulations, ABC. I love the work, and the job is 100% travel, which has afforded me the opportunity to see and experience all that this great country has to offer. It was the love, encouragement, and support of my family that pulled me through, and the faith of our Lord that sustains us all. Myself and the other recruits, those who are left, still remain a close-knit group. The bond will forever exist. Several have died of AIDS, and several have AIDS. As for myself, I've remained completely asymptomatic, thank God. To be honest, in regards to HIV, I haven't seen a doctor since the day I was discharged. While in the Navy, we were subjected to incompetent Navy doctors who often gave us inaccurate medical results. As a result, I came to trust no one in the medical profession. I decided to take things into my own hands. I spent countless hours in the medical library at the Bethesda Naval Hospital, which is where we were being held, and did research on one's immune system and all AIDS information available up to that point in time. Since no drugs had yet been approved by the FDA, there were no forms of treatment available. I came up with my own form of natural health care, which I follow to this very day. I guess you could say that the General Nutrition Center, GNC, Reebok, Step, weightlifting, and good pasta is what keeps me going. Shortly after discharge, AZT was approved by the FDA. My family and friends wanted me to jump on the bandwagon immediately. I can't explain why, but I outright refused. There was this inner voice that kept telling me and continues to tell me to just stay away from medication. Even back then, I had a feeling that taking this medication and going on drug experimental trials would do nothing more than provoke the onset of the disease. Again, this feeling was based not on medical data or research, just an inner gut feeling. I guess you could say my spirit guides or guardian angels have been working overtime. By not going on medication, my family and friends felt I was exhibiting the same ignorance and foolishness that got me into this mess in the first place. We had countless heated arguments over this, but I told them my mind was made up, and that was that, period. We Italian men can oftentimes be quite stubborn. Actually, my dad is the only one who agrees with me. That is reflective in our conversations, which last no longer than a couple of seconds. He only has two questions for me. First, are you still eating a lot? Second, are you still hitting the gym? If I answer yes to both of these questions, then he knows I'll be okay. Sounds like such a simple philosophy for such a complex virus. But Jesus was such a simple man, and people make him out to be so complex. I learned about love and relationships in the underground gay subculture in New York's West Greenwich Village while in my teens. Unfortunately, very unfortunately, that was all that was available to gays at that time. I would have much rather have asked out someone my own age for a date and taken a nice drive down to Fort Myers Beach or Sanibel Island like all kids my age did. But society wouldn't hear of it. Society still wouldn't hear of it. I hope to change all that. During those years of experimenting, exploring, and even rejoicing in my God-given sexuality, I did the bathhouse scene, the saint parties, the S&M sex clubs, the backroom bar scenes, the group sex, etc. I guess you could say that sexually I did it all. I was curious, knew exactly what I wanted to do and experience, and did just that. Something I'm proud of? No, it's just the way it happened. Again, this was all society felt and still feels gays are worthy of. While I was part of the gay scene in this respect, I always felt I wasn't at all in other respects. At about the same time as my Navy situation, I began hearing more and more of guys I had dated in NYC who had died or were dying of AIDS. I speak of approximately 24 friends that I am aware of, there's probably more, who have died of AIDS from 1985 to 1995. They are all gay men, except for one woman. These men were also very much into recreational drugs, steroids, poppers, marijuana, cocaine, ecstasy, etc. They ranged in age from mid-20s to mid-40s. I don't know at what point they started using the drugs such as AZT, DDL, etc. I found out my HIV status while I was in the Navy and didn't even know I was being tested and had not experienced any signs or symptoms of the disease. I don't know if these other friends of mine had already progressed to ARC and full-blown AIDS before finally deciding to get tested and go on medication, or they took it upon themselves early on to have the test done before experiencing any symptoms and then progressed from simply testing HIV positive and then progressing to ARC, full-blown AIDS, and eventually death. My personal suspicion is that these individuals were not aware of their HIV status until they started experiencing physical complications. My friends who were sick and died since the late 80s were taking megadoses of AZT, approximately 12 pills a day. I hear that dosage has been greatly reduced. My friends today take several pills of AZT daily. I'm not sure what the dosage is for any other drugs that they're on. In regards to the woman I mentioned, she was a heterosexual and in her late 20s. I'm not certain how she contracted the disease. She was married with a set of twins that were merely a few years old at the time of her death last year. I believe she suffered approximately 3 years and was on AZT and several other drugs for most of that time. An unfortunate tragedy. Her husband and children test negative. I started to ask myself why I wasn't developing any of the classic symptoms. I literally sat down and made a chart of the similarities between myself and all of these guys who had become sick. I've duplicated it here for you. Looking at this, the only commonality with myself and the others is the sex. In regards to the drug issue, I'm probably the only gay male who could answer the way that I have. Those answers still hold true for me today, a decade later. As I said, my spirit guides or guardian angels have certainly been working overtime for me. My reason for not succumbing to the ill temptations of drugs is simple. I never ever had the desire or curiosity to try them. Whereas with sex, the desire and curiosity was there, and I went out and did exactly what I was looking to do. But with the drugs, that desire or curiosity was never there. I have my two older sisters to thank for that. You see, I lived and spent the first 10 years of my life in the slums of New York City, East Harlem. This was at one time a very close-knit Italian neighborhood that my grandparents settled in when they immigrated from Italy. In the early 1970s, the neighborhood started to change drastically, crime, drugs, etc. My sisters and I have three great sisters, attended the Catholic grammar school up the street from the tenement building in which we lived. When we would leave our building in the morning, we would more often than not be greeted by junkies rolling around in the gutter, shooting up their drugs, clothes all torn, battered, and bruised bodies, etc. It was horrifying. My two older sisters would shield my younger sister and I when passing by. Each day, my older sisters would say, "You see, that's just what happens to you when you try drugs." That is all it took. Those words stayed with me for life. As a result, the desire or curiosity to experiment with drugs was never there for me. I guess something could be said for scare tactics. With regards to HIV, I've always sensed that drugs or lack of them has played a big part in keeping me going while so many others have been less fortunate. Another thing I'd like to add is that as a workout enthusiast, I've never experimented with steroids, which unfortunately run so very, very rampant amongst gays and, in my opinion, is ravaging the gay community. Amongst other things, it severely compromises one's immune system. To me, there's nothing wrong with good old-fashioned, honest, hard work. Several months ago, USA Today ran a story about a talent agency out in California which last year opened a modeling division which strictly promotes HIV models. The name of the agency is the Morgan Agency, and it's located in Costa Mesa, California. The owner of the agency is Mr. Keith Lewis. Mr. Lewis wanted to dispel the myth that HIV individuals are all emaciated-looking people on their deathbeds. He named this division Proof Positive, and within 1 year it has been the fastest-growing division in his talent agency. Some big-name advertisers, such as Nike, have used his models. He feels this segment is going to boom. Well, after reading this article, I wrote Mr. Lewis and sent him some recent snapshots, which I've enclosed for you. When Mr. Lewis called me a few weeks ago, he said he couldn't think of anyone who embodies the spirit or philosophy any better than me, and would love to have me as part of his Proof Positive family. He started to promote me to advertisers immediately. I certainly hope something comes of that. According to the article I've read, it sounds as though you've had a pretty rough time of things in trying to gain support in the medical community and gay community as well. I just wanted to let you know that I share the same views and sentiments as you. If you have any questions at all or would like to contact me for whatever reason, or if I could be of any help to you, feel free to contact me. At the time of discharge, I said that if the good Lord sustains me for 10 years, then I would once again come forward and open myself up to the glare and scrutiny of the public eye and media and serve as an inspiration to millions. This year, 1995, marks the 10-year anniversary of my Navy situation, a milestone in many, many ways. Respectfully, Raphael Sabato Lombardo. The stories of those who believed in AZT. Not all AIDS victims are fortunate enough to question medical authority. The resulting tragedies can sometimes turn into a media circus promoting the HIV hypothesis. Of all the cases hyped up for their AIDS scare value, the Florida woman who supposedly caught AIDS from her dentist has become the most notorious. Kimberly Bergalis. The story began in late 1986 in the small town of Stewart on Florida's Atlantic coast. David Acer, a dentist who had begun his private practice 5 years earlier, felt a bit under the weather and saw a physician. Acer was also an active homosexual, a fact that led him to seek an HIV test. The result came back positive. Although disturbed by the news, he still felt reasonably healthy and saw no reason to stop his dental practice nor, apparently, his fast-track lifestyle. 1 year later, he experienced worsening symptoms and a visit to his doctor confirmed the diagnosis. Full-blown AIDS. A Kaposi sarcoma covered the inside of his throat and his T-cell count had fallen dangerously low. Both symptoms suggested the extensive use of poppers and other drugs so common in the homosexual bathhouse scene. Acer could see his life slowly wasting away. He continued practicing dentistry while remaining discreet about his sexual life and failing health, making sure to follow the standard guidelines for protecting his patients from infection. That December in 1987, he pulled 2 molars from a 19-year-old college student, Kimberly Bergalis. At the time, he had no idea the business major would one day be touted as his hapless victim. The story picks up again in May 1989 when Bergalis developed a transient oral yeast infection. Later that year, during the emotional stress of preparing for an actuarial exam for the state of Florida, she felt some ongoing nausea and she became dizzy during the test itself. Afterwards, the symptoms disappeared, but a brief pneumonia that December sent her to the hospital where the doctor decided out of the blue to test her for HIV. As chance would have it, she had antibodies against the virus. Up to this point, none of her occasional diseases differed from the common health problems many HIV-negative people encounter. But the positive HIV test changed her whole attitude as well as her medical treatment. Within 3 months, the CDC had heard of her case, possibly aided by the presence of several EIS members in the Florida Health Department, and sent investigators to probe further. The CDC team included such EIS members as Harold Jaffe, Ruth Berkelman, and Carol Ciaselski. Bergalis denied any intravenous drug use or blood transfusions and insisted she was a virgin. During the prolonged examination, the CDC officer stumbled across David Acer's positive HIV status and made the connection to Bergalis. Before the HIV hypothesis of AIDS, no medical expert in his right mind would ever have entertained the slightest thought that a dentist with a Kaposi's tumor and a patient with a yeast infection had anything in common. But in the era of AIDS, doctors tended to discard common sense. That the dentist and patient both carried a dormant virus was enough. Excited by its discovery, the CDC boldly advertised its results in its weekly newsletter, the same one that 9 years earlier had broadcast the first 5 AIDS cases. The July 27, 1990 issue prominently featured their amazing leap of logic that the dentist must somehow have infected Bergalis. Naturally, the CDC speculation leapt straight to the front pages and primetime television news broadcasts. Acer died in early September 1990. Bergalis, meanwhile, sought medical care at the University of Miami, where she was treated with an unidentified experimental method. Certainly, this was the appropriate place for such therapies. Margaret Fischel, the head of the Phase 2 AZT trial, worked at that medical center, which had served as one of the 12 facilities sponsored by Burroughs Welcome for the Study. So Bergalis was prescribed AZT. Suddenly, she started a precipitous decline in health. In an angry letter, she partly acknowledged her symptoms resulted from the toxic drug. I have lived through the torturous ache that infested my face and neck, brought on by AZT. I have endured trips twice a week to Miami for 3 months, only to receive painful IV injections. I've had blood transfusions. I've had a bone marrow biopsy. I cried my heart out from the pain. This represented only the beginning. Her yeast infection worsened and became uncontrollable. She lost more than 30 pounds. Her hair gradually fell out. Her blood cells died and had to be replaced with transfusions, and her muscles wasted away. Her fevers hit highs of 103 degrees, and by late 1990, her T-cell count had dropped from the average of 1,000 to a mere 43. She looked just like a chemotherapy patient, which she now was. The CDC saw its golden opportunity in the Brigalis case. It publicized a second report on the Brigalis case, announcing its belief that four of Dr. Acer's other patients had also been infected by him, and even surveyed the patients of other HIV-positive doctors and dentists, suggesting that all HIV-positive patients had also been infected by their doctors. Such CDC-funded organizations as Americans for a Sound AIDS Policy aggressively promoted public fear with these speculations. A media feeding frenzy resulted, with every major television talk show and every national magazine running scare stories. The CDC's relentless publicity had its expected effect. By mid-1991, more than 90% of the public believed HIV-positive doctors should be forced to inform their patients of their status, and a clear majority favored banning such doctors from medical practice. Many doctors, angered by the publicity campaign, accused the Federal Centers for Disease Control of unduly alarming the public. The CDC certainly had an agenda behind its campaign. In July of 1991, the agency issued a set of proposed rules that would require doctors to follow extraordinarily burdensome measures, supposedly to protect their patients from HIV infection. By hyping up the Brigalis case, the CDC had created enough public panic and backlash to favor its proposed regulations. To dramatize the point, Brigalis was brought in to testify before a stunned Senate in October of 1991. Her muscles largely destroyed by AZT, she had to be brought in a wheelchair. Her furious testimony, whispered into the microphone, made a powerful emotional impact on the attentive congressman and the television audience. Congress soon passed a new law requiring the states to adopt the CDC guidelines or else begin losing federal funds. When the medical profession resisted the new rules, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, which works closely with the CDC, stepped in with parallel rules of its own. On threat of criminal prosecution, laboratory and medical workers must now follow incredibly restrictive regulations on their practices and equipment and must deal with extra bureaucratic red tape. Blaming her deteriorating condition on the latent virus supposedly passed on by her dentist, Brigalis sued the Acer estate. She received a $1 million award plus unannounced compensation from the dentist's insurance company. She parceled out the money to a variety of friends, family, members, and AIDS organizations and told her father to purchase a new red Porsche and deliver it to my aunt with a large bow on top. Had she known better, she could have instead sued Burroughs Wellcome. Brigalis died in December 1991 at 23 years of age, having taken AZT for up to 2 years. Her death became the ultimate symbol of the deadly powers of HIV. No one pointed out that according to the HIV hypothesis, the virus should take 10 years to kill its victims, particularly someone like Brigalis with no other risk factors. She had died within 4 years of her initial visit to Dr. Acer. As her symptoms would indicate, AZT must have killed her instead. In December 1992, another former patient of Dr. Acer tested positive for HIV, but had no symptoms. 2 months later, 18-year-old Sherry Johnson began taking AZT. She has since begun wasting away, admitting she periodically feels sick. The CDC continued to exploit the Brigalis story as proof of the risk of doctor-to-patient HIV transmission. Some 1,100 of Acer's 2,000 former clients volunteered for HIV tests. 7 of these were positive, including Brigalis, 2 of them having standard risk factors for AIDS. That left 5 people who supposedly caught the virus from Acer. Expanding its search, the CDC tested almost 16,000 total patients of some 32 HIV-positive doctors around the country, finding 84 infected patients. Though admittedly baffled by how HIV could pass from doctors and dentists to the patients, the CDC nonetheless advertised the alleged threat. Curiously, when confronted with an unexpected outcome for an unproved test, the CDC did not proceed with caution. It published its findings in July 1990 without further verification. Apart from HIV being a harmless virus, the evidence that this virus has ever been medically transmitted remains dubious. Based on their own research, insurance companies concluded that the HIV strains in the five patients were different from that in ACER, meaning each caught it from a different source. A study out of Florida State University has backed this conclusion. Even the CDC acknowledged this evidence, though it still preferred to believe the dentist had infected Burgalis. But the CDC's own numbers give away the reality. An estimated 1 million Americans have HIV in a total population of 250 million. Thus, 1 in 250 Americans have the virus. 5 HIV-infected patients of Dr. Acer out of 1,100 tested comes to 1 in 220, virtually identical to the national average. So does the proportion of HIV positives from the patients of the 32 doctors, which works out to in 188. This HIV-positive patients merely represent random samples from the general population. And where did these people get the virus? As suggested in Chapter 6, HIV is probably transmitted much as other retroviruses, from mother to child during pregnancy. There is no evidence that Kimberly Burgalis's mother has never been tested for HIV antibodies, nor that the mothers of Dr. Acer's other patients were tested. Perhaps Kimberly carried the harmless virus for 23 years. The CDC's theory that AIDS was transmitted from Dr. Acer to his patient began to crumble in the mainstream press in 1994 when an investigative reporter researched the alleged victims of Dr. Acer. He found weak evidence, shoddy science, and the work of a very accomplished malpractice attorney. The report first cast doubts on the time course of AIDS transmission from Dr. Acer to his patients. She developed AIDS just 2 years after the surgery, and only 2% of HIV-positive patients developed the full-blown disease that quickly. The investigation disclosed that one of the 6 other patients that Acer presumably infected had visited the dentist's office only once for a cleaning by a hygienist, not by Acer himself. The report further calls into question the exclusive reliance of the CDC and the malpractice attorney of the Acer 6 on the DNA fingerprinting technique to match Acer's virus with those of his patients. This same technique had also been used to determine that the NIH researcher Gallo had claimed HIV obtained from his French rival Montagnier as his own. Several experts have directly challenged the DNA fingerprinting that linked Acer to his patients, claiming that instead, Burgalis' virus matched other HIV strains much more closely. In view of this, a writer in the New York Times commented, "The CDC owes it to the public to reopen Acer's case." The reinvestigation of the Acer 6 proves unknowingly yet another reason why the CDC owes it to the public to reopen this case. It supports the hypothesis that AIDS is caused by recreational drugs and AZT. Only 3 of the Acer 6 have developed AIDS, and every one of them was on drugs. Burgalis was on AZT. A 30-year-old male was involved with drug dealers and a homosexual relationship, and another male was a notorious crackhead. While on AZT, Burgalis once told a reporter she hoped to also get didioxyinosine, DDL, another experimental AIDS drug. This drug and DDC, 2 products of cancer chemotherapy research, work in precisely the same way as AZT. Chemically altered building blocks of DNA, they enter the growing chain of DNA while a cell is preparing to divide and abort the process by preventing the new DNA building blocks from adding on. So like AZT, DDL and DDC kill dividing cells and have similar toxic effects. They destroy white blood cells and therefore can cause AIDS. The only difference between DDL, DDC, and AZT lies in how easily each is absorbed into the body. People who absorb one evidently may not be equally affected by the other. Allison Gertz. Both DDL and DDC have begun to claim their victims. In 1988, 22-year-old New York socialite and aspiring graphic artist Allison Gertz entered the hospital for a fever and diarrhea. At some point, the doctor decided to test for HIV and found antibodies against HIV. Gertz's transient illness was re-diagnosed as AIDS. She had not injected drugs, although her wilder days at Studio 54 bespoke the cocaine and other free drugs available to patrons. A process of elimination traced her infection to a one-night stand with a bisexual male 6 years earlier. The announcement left her feeling depressed, but she began a lecture circuit at high schools and colleges, admonishing students that AIDS could come from a single sexual encounter. Television talk shows followed, as did the cover of People magazine and Woman of the Year for Esquire. Even the World Health Organization circulated a documentary featuring her story. Gert started AZT treatment in 1989. The 1990 People magazine profile recounted the consequent disaster. Last October, she was hospitalized with a severe allergic reaction to AZT. When doctors called for a lung biopsy, Ali balked. "I told them if they put me to sleep, I'd never wake up," she says. "My strength was gone." Released after 17 days, she recuperated at home where her mother and girlfriends took turns nursing her around the clock. "They'd help me to the bathroom, feed me, see that I didn't fall in the shower," says Ali. "My knees were so bony I had to sleep with a pillow between them." The doctor switched her to the still experimental DDL, which Gertz apparently did not absorb as well and thus allowed her partly to recover. She mixed the powder in her drink twice every day. Her immune system and general health declined, though more slowly. Gertz remains susceptible to infections like thrush, a fungus that frequently affects the mouth, stated the People article. She has lost 30 pounds since last summer, naps each afternoon, and continues to visit her doctor every 10 days. Ultimately, the ravages of the chemotherapy took her life in August 1992, the news media advertising her death as AIDS-related. She was only 26. A backlash is now rising against the toxic and irrational treatment approaches to AIDS. In 1993, during the 9th International AIDS Conference in Berlin, Germany, medical reporter Lori Garrett was interviewed on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour. She described the growing discontent among scientists and patients alike. "Most drug trials were terminated early. The AZT trial was terminated early, DDL, DDC, and so on, and people were allowed as soon as there was any sign that something showed promise to jump out of the placebo arm and get into the treatment arm." Dr. Anthony Pinching, who was really the leader of most of the clinical research related to AIDS in the United Kingdom, gave a very important speech this morning. "I think if he had given this precise same speech a year ago, he would have been booed off the stage, and this morning he was applauded heavily. And what he basically was saying was, we have no idea what drugs work, we have no idea what we're doing in treatment, and it's time to return to the use of placebo trials." He went a step further and said that at least in Europe, a lot of AIDS activists and patients now agree because they're shocked to find out that the drugs they've been taking, thinking they would be helpful, might even be hurtful. Arthur Ashe. This lesson almost saved the life of the late Arthur Ashe, the tennis star and one-time Wimbledon champion, who died in 1993, supposedly of AIDS. Ashe's medical problems surfaced in 1979 with a heart attack, despite his young age of 36. In December, he underwent quadruple bypass surgery. His chronic heart condition continued plaguing him, and by 1983, he had double bypass surgery. A blood transfusion during either one of the operations may have carried HIV. His heart condition and its complications nagged him for several years. Then in 1988, he entered the hospital for toxoplasmosis, a protozoal disease relatively uncommon in humans. The germ resides in cattle and household pets, and in 17% to 50% of the U.S. population, but most people never succumb to the disease because of healthy immune systems. This also happens to be one of the many diseases on the AIDS list, so the doctor tested and found Ashe to be HIV positive. Although his toxoplasmosis soon disappeared, Ashe was pronounced an AIDS victim. His disease was retroactively blamed on HIV, not on his heart condition. Yet his condition hardly seemed contagious. Neither his wife nor his daughter, born 3 years after his second transfusion, ever developed any AIDS conditions. Indeed, his immune system must have neutralized HIV quite effectively, as Ashe never transmitted the virus to his family. His daily medicine intake expanded to a virtual pharmacy. He continued to take several drugs for his heart problems, one to lower cholesterol by interfering with liver function, another to slow down the heartbeat, and three others, including nitroglycerin, to lower blood pressure. To these, his doctors added a spectrum of antibiotics, all with mild to serious side effects to prevent the possibility of opportunistic infections. Ashe took Cleocin to fight further toxoplasmosis, Nystatin to slow down yeast infections, and toxic petamidine to stave off pneumocystis pneumonia. Two other drugs were prescribed against possible brain seizures. Eventually, his daily regimen included some 30 pills, only a few of them vitamins. But just as soon as Ash received his AIDS diagnosis in 1988, his doctor pushed him into taking AZT. He started on an unbelievably high dose, nearly double the seriously toxic levels used in the phase 2 trial. His doctor only gradually lowered the dose over the next 4 years. "I refuse to dwell on how much damage I may have done to myself taking the higher dosage," Ash later admitted. In early 1992, he established an acquaintance that came close to rescuing him. A close friend arranged a series of meetings with Gary Null, a New York-based radio talk show host and nutritionist. Null introduced Ash to the evidence of AZT's toxicity and against the HIV-AIDS hypothesis, desperately trying to convince him to halt the therapy. For the next 10 months, Ash wrestled with the possibility of breaking away from the medical establishment to seek alternative treatment for AIDS, according to one columnist. Ash never met Peter Duisberg, but became familiar with his arguments. "He read everything, he studied what we gave him, and asked lots of questions," recalled Null. In October, Ash announced the lessons he was learning in a column he wrote for the Washington Post. "The confusion for AIDS patients like me is that there is a growing school of thought that HIV may not be the sole cause of AIDS, and that standard treatments such as AZT actually make matters worse. That there may very well be unknown cofactors, but that the medical establishment is too rigid to change the direction of basic research and/or clinical trials." But psychological pressure stopped Ash short from rejecting AZT. As Null stated, he wanted to do it, but he would say, "What will I tell my doctors?" In his 1993 book, Days of Grace, a memoir, Ash openly acknowledged his interest in alternative AIDS hypotheses. But AZT was controversial in other ways. A gift from heaven to many desperate people, it was poison to others. Developed for use in cancer chemotherapy to destroy cells, then in the process of actively dividing, AZT was only later applied to AIDS. Some scientists believe that AZT, which relentlessly kills cells but cannot distinguish between infected and uninfected cells, is as harmful as AIDS itself. After all, HIV is present in only one of every 10,000 T cells, which are vital to the immune system. But AZT kills them all. Dr. Peter Duisberg, the once eminent and now controversial professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California, who bitterly disputes the notion that HIV causes AIDS, has called AZT AIDS by prescription. Dr. Duisberg argues that the use of recreational drugs, not sex, led to AIDS. It is well known that many gay men use and many of them continue to use drug stimulants in sexual activity or to facilitate intercourse. Natural and synthetic psychoactive drugs, he has argued, drugs such as cocaine, amphetamine, heroin, quaaludes, and amyl nitrates and butyl nitrates, or poppers, are the only new pathogens around since the 1970s, and the only new disease syndrome around is AIDS, and both are found in exactly the same populations. Ash faithfully summarized the main points against the HIV hypothesis and for the drug AIDS hypothesis and explained the deadly effects of AZT and the flaws of its phase 2 trial. Some tolerate AZT for a while, then must give it up. Still others cannot tolerate it at all, wrote Ash. "To my relief, I tolerate AZT fairly easily." With that rationalization, he sealed his fate. During 1992, his doctors placed him on DDL. Each morning, he sprinkled the powder on his cereal in addition to the AZT pills he swallowed throughout the day. By this time, he was wasting away rapidly, his underweight frame hidden by loose clothes. He began rotating in and out of the hospital. January of the following year brought more bad news. Now he had a serious case of pneumocystis pneumonia that his poisoned immune system could no longer fight off. He never recovered. On February 6, 1993, he breathed his last. The list of celebrity AIDS patients who died on AZT for their belief in medical authority includes ballet star Rudolf Nureyev, who died in 1993, Randy Schultz, the author of the bestseller and the band played on, and who died in 1994, and many more. As a thoroughly politicized epidemic, AIDS began with a falsehood and ended in tragedy. Virus hunters in the CDC-directed public health movement first made the new syndrome appear contagious. Virus hunters in the NIH-funded research establishment then blamed AIDS on a retrovirus. And virus hunters in the NIH, CDC, FDA, and pharmaceutical industry exploited the situation by resurrecting failed cancer chemotherapeutic drugs for AIDS treatment. In the crisis atmosphere created by the CDC, which allowed no time to think before acting, Such toxic drugs as AZT, DDL, and DDC could bypass the normal review procedures and achieve a sanctified monopoly status. The final results have been an unnecessary death toll and an artificially expanding AIDS epidemic. To make all this possible, the virus hunters from all fields first had to join forces. They've used their combined influence, often behind the scenes, to mobilize the government, media, and other institutions behind a global war on AIDS. Few outsiders have realized just how coordinated the whole strategy has been. The story behind this war and how its leaders are actively suppressing dissent is told in the next chapter.